Wheaton College, it's a marvelous place. I've been there a few times, you know, and while Clyde Kelly was still alive, and then with Lyle Dorsett, who headed up the Wade Collection. That's the Wade Collection that has all this amazing collection of C.S. Lewis material, G.K. Chesterton material, and, of course, Dorothy Sayers material as well. And now Frederick Buechner is giving his private papers to Wheaton College, too. I think Chuck Colson as well. It's just an amazing collection, of archival collection of papers, but especially Lewis and Owen Barfield, all the Inklings. So it's so great. You know, Lewis had so much respect for Dorothy Sayers, and of course I absolutely love Dorothy Sayers. I've tried to read everything of hers. But she was a woman, and the Inklings were all men. That was their loss, not to have Dorothy Sayers. She would have filled the room with smoke, I'm sure, a lot. Wow. Thank you for coming again for this second in our series of lectures. We're calling this Caught Off Guard, C.S. Lewis, the man. So last week we looked at the man's journey, his own journey of faith, the writer. Tonight we're going to look at Lewis the writer. And then next week, Lewis, the defender of Christian faith and theologian. He was a tremendous gift to us in the sharing of the Christian faith. And then the last 2 weeks, I want to look at his great book, Letters from Hell, his Screwtape Letters. And then the last week, his great stories of the marvelous, the Chronicles of Narnia. And so that's what we're going to do in our time together. There is 1 week off during the National Prayer Breakfast week. I decided not to compete with the National Prayer Breakfast. So we do have that one Wednesday when I'm not having a lecture that night. So it's next week, and then we have a week off for the National Prayer Breakfast, and then 2 weeks after that. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for this chance to be together as friends and new friends that we're making with one another. And then the chance to consider the writings and the life of this man who's become a mentor to so many. And we thank you for his life and for those who influenced his life and those who he's influenced. So, Lord, bless us as we take a look at this man, Clive Staples Lewis, writer. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Last week we looked at the journey of his life. And all that we tried to sketch in some of the influences in his life. And I did mention a couple of books that some people asked about those. I do want to once again just say the book, I didn't bring it with me tonight, but the Narnian is probably the newest book on Lewis. I think it's fantastic. And then this book is totally outstanding. And it's written by Colin Durez. And it's a book called Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, The Gift of Friendship. It tracks both men's lives. And it is such an amazing book. I just can't speak too highly of this book if you're going to start collecting and buying Lewis books. And, you know, if you are a collector of Lewis books or Inklings, Tolkien, of course, is one of the great Inklings. If you're going to collect Lewis, it's not hard because everything that Lewis wrote really is in print. And it's in paperback. And you can collect. I always say to young people when you're collecting, don't ever belong to Book of the Month Club or anything like that. Don't let other people pick your books. But when you find an author you like, then collect that author. A person like Lewis is easy because you can go to used bookstores and you can just look under L and look under Lewis, see if there's a book you haven't got yet. And then just start to collect. I think I've got everything of Lewis, not everything that's been written about Lewis. I just found out from the librarian at Princeton that he, right now, is number one, and then Carl Barth is the other, number one for doctoral dissertations right now, this last year, with C.S. Lewis. So, I mean, when you talk about books about Lewis, you're just going to have such a collection. But I haven't tried to collect all of those, believe me. But I have collected all of Lewis, and you can do that. You can collect all of Bonhoeffer. You can collect all of J.R.R. Tolkien, and you can do it by just collecting books, used books, and going to Amazon.com if you want to spend a lot of money and get them from them. But that's what you do. So this is one, by all means, that you should put in the collection, Tolkien and Lewis. Tonight, Lewis the writer. What kind of a writer was he? He wrote a lot. He wrote letters, first of all. And I've given you a few last week. I'm going to give you more this week. But Lewis wrote letters. He answered every letter he got. And toward the end of his life, he said he felt it was a duty, it was a responsibility, it was a pastoral responsibility to answer letters. And his brother helped him, his brother typed him off, and Lewis wrote everything longhand. But then his brother would often type letters. And he answered school children, he answered people who wrote to him, he answered critics. He just was a great letter writer. I said this last week, I'll say it one more time, he did not save any letters that were written to him. After 7 days, he said, he commits every letter to the flame. And he hopes that others commit my letters to the flame. But no one ever did. And we're grateful for that, because we have all of these wonderful Lewis letters, because the people he wrote to did not commit his letters to the flame. But also he kept a diary for a short time in his life. He was not a great diarist. The only diary collection we have, in fact, one of the last books to be published about Lewis, or of Lewis's works, is the diaries of 1921 to 1927. So we do have that one period in his life. It's before he became a Christian, but it's so interesting. I read one excerpt last week from this. It's so interesting to see Lewis at that young period of his life, when he's in his early 20s, a young scholar at Oxford, and when he did keep a diary. And so we have it. All my road before me is the Lewis diary. Then he stopped. In 1927, he just stopped keeping a diary. So from then on, we depend on his letters in order to sketch in his life. And also his, finally, he did write two autobiographical books. So then he wrote poems. I have his collection of poems. I don't think Lewis was as good a poet as he was a writer of novels and a writer of prosaic literature. But he did write poems. In fact, if you read All That I Wrote Before Me, which is in the 20s, you'll see that he was totally focused on this one poem he was working on called the Dymir poem. And it's a grim reaper poem. It's a sad poem, very, very gloomy. And he was spending all his time on that poem. And finally he did publish it under a pseudonym. He used his mother's maiden name to publish it. He published it under Clive Hamilton. His mother's maiden name was Hamilton. And he gave it to his mother's sister, Aunt Lily. I'm going to read you one thing he wrote about Aunt Lily. And to ask Aunt Lily what she thought of it. And she did not like it very much. But nor did anyone else. And so maybe that was the end of his official attempt to publish a lot of poetry. Because I think some of his later poems, when he relaxed and wrote poems later, are really quite good. Some of his nativity poems are beautiful. But he was a poet. He wrote literary criticism. That means he wrote books that analyzed other books and analyzed literature. And he wrote beautiful, in my opinion, profound literary criticism. The Allegory of Love is a book of literary criticism. Cambridge University Press has published about 5 of his literary essays where he would analyze. If the best one, get his essays and read his analysis of Hamlet. It's absolutely magnificent. The way he analyzes it, some of his favorite writers, and he did that beautifully. Henny wrote science fiction. In the middle point of his writing career, in the early 40s, he decided to write science fiction. 3 of them. Out of the Silent Planet, Perelandra, and That Hideous Strength. And I think they're terrifying and scary, and really marvelous novels. That's science fiction. And then he wrote one book, which was a retelling of Greek mythology. And that was his book, Till We Have Faces. He felt it was the very best thing he ever wrote, was Till We Have Faces. It's one of his last works. It's not a book for children. It's a very profound study of the myth of Psyche. And so he wrote that. So he wrote those kinds of novels. He was a lecturer and gave lectures and wrote essays on Christian themes. So that we know him very well for. Because one of the set of lectures he gave was during wartime, and there's now a whole book, I left that in Seattle, but a whole book telling about his wartime lectures, which tells the whole story of how BBC came to him to ask him to give lectures during World War II. And he came and gave the famous broadcast talks of World War II. And those were later published in the book Mere Christianity, which the C.S. Lewis Institute is giving as a gift tonight. That is a treasure. It's his most published of all works, is the broadcast talks he gave in World War II called Mere Christianity. So he gave lectures. And then he wrote direct Christian apologetic works. And I'm going to say more about those next week, because next week I want to talk about Lewis the theologian. But they started mainly with the book The Problem of Pain, then the book Miracles, and essays that were about the Christian themes. And then he wrote satire. The satire is marvelous. The Screwtape Letters is probably his most famous satirical book. In fact, the New York Times, when they reviewed it, said it's the finest piece of religious satire of the 20th century, was the Screwtape Letters. He was in church one day, and he wrote to his brother in 1941. He said, I had an idea in church today of a of a senior devil writing to a junior devil. I don't know what the preacher was preaching on, but he said, I had this idea of a senior devil writing to a junior devil. So that is the first hint we have of a wonderful book, The Screwtape Letters, which I'm going to devote a whole evening to, so you can wait for that. That'll be, because I think it's one of his masterpieces. It was The Screwtape Letters. He also wrote satire toward the end of his life, Letters to Malcolm Chiefly on Prayer, which I think is one of the finest things on prayer I've ever read. Again, it's satirical because there is no Malcolm. He just creates a fictional character and writes satirically to a man who's carrying a dialogue with on prayer. And I think it's one of his masterpieces, too. Letters to Malcolm, Chiefly on Prayer. I find that very few people are aware of that book, though it was actually published after he died. He wrote it just before he died. Anybody... How many of you have read Letters to Malcolm, Chiefly on Prayer? Boy, the rest of you are in for a great gift. Letters to Malcolm, Chiefly on Prayer. So that is, again, satirical. He wrote The Great Divorce, another satirical work that is just marvelous. And then he wrote autobiography. His most famous autobiography was A Shave of My Early Life, Surprised by Joy. And he doesn't mean Joy Davidman, the woman who later became his wife. He's talking about Surprised by Joy, Chara. And it's a play on words, because he knows that the word for grace, charis, is built from the Greek word chara, which means joy or surprise. And it means surprise. So he's playing on the word. He knew Greek very well. He knew many languages. But it's surprise by surprise. And that is a wonderful, wonderful book. I read last week from that book where he tells about when his mother died, it was like the continent left, and all he had was islands after that. And all the certitude was gone. And then also, I read to you the section about when he met the great Knock, W.T. Kirkpatrick, who played such a role in his life. I read that to you. That's from Surprised by Joy. Also, after Joy Davidman died, he wrote his feelings about her death in an autobiographical book called A Grief Observed. And again, he published that with a pseudonym under the name of C.N. Clerk. And then... he later admitted that he was the one who wrote that book. It was an amazing book. Some people think it is the most beautiful thing he ever wrote, was A Grief Observed, after the death of Joy Davidman. And it's a book of despair, in a way, and of heartbreak, and also of faith and of hope. And best of all, he wrote Stories in the Marvelous, what he called the Stories of the Marvelous. His great friend J.R. Tolkien had written Stories of the Marvelous. Remember, Lewis always was talking, making jokes about the fact that his great friend J.R. Tolkien was writing and reading to us about his hobbits. And his hobbits were, of course, The Lord of the Rings. And that is the greatest masterpiece, I think, of fantasy literature ever written, was written by J.R. Tolkien, and who was the great friend of C.S. Lewis. And C.S. Lewis wrote what I think is the high water mark in many ways of everything he wrote when he relaxed in 1950. That's when he started to write The Chronicles of Narnia. Originally only going to write, he was only going to write one. He was writing Lion only as a gift for his godchild, Lucy Barfield. His good friend Owen Barfield's daughter was Lucy. And that's why Lucy's the hero. And it was for her. And guess what happened? He got caught up. And he ended up writing 7 Chronicles of Narnia. And they are, in my opinion, an absolute high watermark in Lewis. He relaxed, and he wrote these wonderful, wonderful stories. And I want to devote an entire evening to them. Now, why is his writing so durable and so engaging? And that's a question I want to ask tonight. Why are these books and all these letters and everything he wrote, why are they so durable? I mean, you think about it for a minute. Screwtape Letters was written in 1941. You give me another book written in 1941, and you read it, and you see if it makes any sense at all. If it doesn't just sound trivial. Or read an apologetic book at that time, trying to make the case for Christianity, that was written around 1940 or 1939, and see if it doesn't seem just childish in some cases. And not even aware of the ambiguities of life. That's not true of Lewis. Lewis, in the Screwtape Letters, has written in the early 40s a book that is absolutely, there is a kind of durability about it. And you don't write it off. And so people do not write Lewis off. Still, young people find him as appealing. Youth who are postmodernists find him as appealing as do traditionalists. And he has that ability to bridge that gap. Why? Why is he so good as a writer? And what can you, if you're a writer, I should give this, this lecture should be C.S. Lewis, the friend of writers. Because if you're a writer, and I hope you all are, and I hope you will all write. I want you guys to write. And write things. And if you are a writer, Lewis is your friend. And Lewis is a great inspiration and a model. And those of you who are young, and those of you who are old. By the way, George Bernard Shaw did his best work when he was old. C.S. Lewis did his best work when he was in the older period of his life. And Mark Twain did his best work when he was in the older period of his life. And so, hey, don't ever stop writing. And because you get seasoned and you get a little more mellow and you end up writing your best stuff. Okay. Why is his writing so good? I want to make seven reflections tonight on why I think he's such a great writer. First, he uses short sentences. You know, this is an inside joke among writers. The English writers are noted for writing with shorter sentences. The Germans, long sentences. Karl Barth is my other hero. And I want to tell you, the difference between a Karl Barth sentence and a C.S. Lewis sentence is really remarkable. It takes about three breaths to get through a Karl Barth sentence. With one breath, and you can get through a C.S. Lewis sentence. And his chapters are short. Short chapters, short sentences. And that is a part of the secret. And his sentences are always clear, straightforward, with wise word choices. And by the way, that will do you in faster than anything else in making you not timeful and not durable if you have careless word choices. Like using words like, what an exquisite evening it was. Don't ever say exquisite. What in the world is that supposed to mean? Like, would you stand from Niagara Falls and say it's cute? Or, it's the wrong word. It's the wrong word. Or, it's exquisite. Exquisite? Lewis never does that. So, he uses very wise word choices. I'm going to give you Lewis himself making that case in a letter he wrote to a school child. I read you one school child letter last week. I'll read you another one. You know, every child that wrote to him and asked for advice on writing, he answered. And here's a wonderful letter to a girl. A schoolgirl in America. And she wrote at her teacher's suggestion to request advice on writing. And Lewis wrote, answered this in 1959. One, turn off the radio. Now, he would add TV. And iPod. And text messaging. Hate that. Turn off the radio. That's one. Two, read all the good books you can. Avoid nearly all magazines. Three, always write and read with your ear, not your eye. You should hear every sentence you write as if it were being read aloud or spoken. If it does not sound nice, try again. Interesting. That's key of Shakespeare, too. Shakespeare sounds good. See? Mark Twain sounds good. Oh, man, if you can pronounce his English dialect, it sounds good. All right. Four. Here's a good one. Write about what really interests you, whether it is real things or imaginary things, and nothing else. Notice this means that if you're interested only in writing, you'll never be a writer because you'll have nothing to write about. And a lot of kids that have to produce an essay for class will appreciate that. Write about what interests you. I've told that to you people when I've given talks on writing poetry. Always write poetry at the beginning. Don't write a poem about world peace. It doesn't interest you that much. It's sort of like everybody's in favor of it. Don't write about that. Write about an odd relative in your family. That's the person to write about. And then you'll write a good poem. So he said, write about what really interests you. Five. Take great pains to be clear. This is Lewis. Remember W.T. Kirkpatrick over his shoulder? Remember that though you start by knowing what you mean, the reader doesn't. And a single ill-chosen word may lead him or her to a total misunderstanding. In a story, it is terribly easy just to forget that you have not told the reader something he really needs to know. The whole picture is so clear in your own mind, you forget it isn't clear in his mind. Six, when you give up a bit of work, don't, unless it's hopelessly bad, throw it away. Put it in a drawer. It may come in useful later. Much of my best work, or what I think is my best, is the rewriting of things that I had begun and abandoned years earlier. Wow, that is so good. Save everything you write. I've tried to follow that advice. Do it. Save everything you write. And that's why, can I tell you something? And this is my own bias. Lewis wrote everything longhand. I write everything longhand. I've written 18 books. They're all written longhand. And I like that better than a word processor. In a word processor, when you correct and remove the word that you say, I don't want that word, and you correct and you just erase it, and then you go on to another, then you don't have the benefit of seeing what you first thought. Your first idea. I went to the Victor Hugo, another one of my heroes is Victor Hugo, I think Les Miserables, one of the three greatest novels of all time. And when I went to the Victor Hugo Museum in Guernsey, be sure you do it if you have. They have a museum at the bottom to show you excerpts from his manuscript of Les Miserables. And I was so impressed. He writes the way I write. He writes the way Lewis writes. You see him in longhand, and then you see a line from a page. He scratches it out, and you see a line over here and a big circle around here, a substitute paragraph, substitute lines. But you can see what he originally thought. And then said, no, I don't want that. And Lewis did the same thing. He'll scratch out, but don't completely destroy it. Let him see what you thought first. And then you'll come back, and you often get your best stuff that way. So he says, don't throw anything away. Save it. And then 7, don't use a typewriter. I think he would say word processor here. The noise will destroy your sense of rhythm, which still needs years of training. And then finally, be sure you know the meaning of every word you use. Okay, that's his advice to a school child. Lewis followed it. And I think that's why he's a great writer. So if you want to be a great writer, follow that advice. 2, Lewis is a superb describer. I already hinted at this last week, but you just have to realize he was a great describer. Let me read you an example with Aunt Lily. Remember I told you his Aunt Lily was his favorite. She was his mother. Lewis did not like his dad's relatives. His dad's brothers, he had nicknames for all of them, Jack Popo and stuff like that. And they were, like he said, they were just fragments of our father. He said at one point, they had all his bad qualities and none of his good qualities. And so that was the description of all his uncles. He couldn't stand them. And but his mother's aunt, Aunt Lily, he adored, but she was quirky. By the way, everybody in Lewis's life seemed to be quirky, including Lewis. Lewis was definitely a quirky person. And in 1922, when that means he's 23 years old, he just started Oxford after having come back from the war and having been wounded, and his Aunt Lily comes to visit him. Now listen to his description of Aunt Lily. Talk about a describer. I wish I could describe this way. You could get in trouble, though, describing this way, I realize. But in 1922, he wrote this. Actually, this is from his diary. This is in the diary. Aunt Lily has been here for 3 days, and she has snubbed a bookseller in Oxford, written to the local newspaper, crossed swords with the vicar's wife, and started a quarrel with her landlord. Her conversation is like an old drawer, full of both rubbish and valuable things, but all thrown together in great disorder. What a description. Don't you wish you could describe that way? She is still engaged on her essay, which starting 3 years ago, as a tract on the then state of women's suffrage. It's still unfinished. Now embraces a complete philosophy on the significance of heroism and maternal instinct. The nature of matter, the primal one, the value of Christianity, and the purpose of existence. She has too many themes. That purpose, by the way, is a return of differences to the one through the heroism and pain. She thus combines a good deal of Schopenhauer, German philosopher, and a good deal of theosophy, besides being indebted to Bergson and Plotinus. She told me that ectoplasm, you know, bubbles? Ectoplasm was done with soap bubbles, that women had no balance and were cruel as doctors, and that what I needed for my poetry was a steeping in scientific ideas and terminology, and that many prostitutes were extraordinarily purified and Christ-like, and that Plato was a Bolshevik, and that the importance of Christ could not have lain in what he said, and that Pekingese were not dogs, but were dwarfed lions, bred from smaller and ever smaller specimens by the Chinese through age innumerable. and that matter was just a stop of motion, and that the cardinal error of all religions was made by man was the assumption that God existed for or cared about us. Well, he says, I left Daimler, that was his poem, with her and got away with some difficulty at 1 o'clock. And, but she didn't particularly like his poem. But he adored her. But she was this amazing mixture of, and the way he describes her, isn't that amazing? I think his description is wonderful in the last book. Did you know the last major book that Lewis wrote, except for Letters to Malcolm Chufi on prayer, was An Experiment in Criticism? Okay, I'm going to raise his hand again. How many of you are aware of this book? It's one of his non-religious books. Hey, that's better. But again, the rest of you are in for a great treat. I think Experiment in Criticism is the best book on Bible study I've ever read. It's a book by Lewis, written just shortly before he died, on how to read a book. How to read a book. And it is absolutely wonderful. And again, some of the descriptive sections in it are so vintage Lewis, I couldn't resist reading one. He talks about, at one point, fantasy literature and what he calls literature written for children, because a lot of people were making fun of what they called the juveniles. See, books written for children were called juveniles, like the Chronicles of Narnia, and people were even writing off Lord of the Rings that way. And just like Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn was written off by so many people as a juvenile, a book written for kids, when in my opinion, it's the crowning jewel of American literature, is Huckleberry Finn. And yet for a long time, no one took it seriously because it was written for children. And so he's quite upset about that. He decides to defend books written for children. Listen to what he says. Secondly, if we're to use the word childish or infantile in terms of disapproval, we must make sure that they refer only to those characteristics of childhood that we become better and happier by outgrowing, and not those things which every sane man would keep if he could, and which some are fortunate for keeping. On the bodily level, this, now notice he's a great illustrator. On the bodily level, this is sufficiently obvious. We're glad to have outgrown the muscular weakness of childhood, but we envy those who retain its energy, its well-fatched scalp, its easily won sleeps, and its power of rapid recuperation. But surely the same is true at another level. The sooner we cease to be as fickle or boastful or jealous or cruel or ignorant or easily frightened as most children are, the better we are and for our neighbors. But who in his senses would not keep, if he could, that tireless curiosity, that intensity of imagination, that facility of suspending disbelief? Don't you love that description? That unspoiled appetite, that readiness to wonder, to pity, and to admire. He's talking about what children see, and that's why when you write a book for children, you write for these things. Then he says, the process of growing up is to be valued for what we gain, not for what we lose. Not to acquire a taste for the realistic. See, they were making fun of children's stories because they weren't realistic enough. Like, they made fun of his Chronicles of Narnia because he had no erotic scenes in there. There would be adult themes. No, he didn't. So he says, you should be more realistic. Have a few more murders or a few more rape scenes or something like that, maybe. Not to acquire a taste for the realistic is childish in the bad sense. But to have lost the taste for marvels and for adventures is no more a matter for congratulation than losing your teeth. Isn't that great? Or your hair. Or your palate. Or finally, your hopes. Why do we hear so much about the defects of immaturity and so little about those of senility? And he wrote this just before he died. So he had that marvelous ability to describe. And here to describe ideas that way. That's Experimenting Criticism. Wonderful, wonderful book. He's a describer. Three, there's a basic humor thread that's like a thread through everything Lewis writes. And that humor thread, it runs through everything he writes, almost. And I don't want you to miss that. Now I've got a really funny thing to read to you from his diary. Remember, a few weeks ago, I gave a quotation. One of my favorite poets is T.S. Eliot. I'm a T.S. Eliot fan. I have the complete works of T.S. Eliot. I just conned her into buying the complete works of T.S. Eliot. I quoted in a sermon a few weeks ago, Journey of the Magi, the wonderful poem where Eliot sort of announces his Christianity. Absolutely magnificent poem. I love J. Alfred Prufrock, his first poem he wrote as a young man. I can't say I love The Wasteland. It's just too hard to understand. Hollow Men, I can understand better. But then everything else he wrote, I absolutely love. And Murder in the Cathedral is a masterpiece. Eliot was a powerful, powerful figure in the English scene. And he was he had a magazine called The Criterion, which was the sort of absolute judge of literary works. And in the 20s, see, in the 1920s. And he won the Nobel Prize, see, so that made him very big time. And he also controlled Oxford Press, what would be published of poetry. He was so powerful. And I have to tell you, Lewis, at the end of Lewis's life, he came to appreciate T.S. Eliot. I have to tell you that before I read this. Sort of like everybody says, oh, Martin Luther didn't like the book of James. Well, that's true. Early on, he said, I would throw Jimmy in the fire. Martin Luther didn't like the book of James, but he later came to respect it and love it. So, same thing with Lewis. Lewis did not like T.S. Eliot. He thought he was a stuffed shirt, by the way he was. Talk about an American who renounced his American citizenship to become British. What do you call a person like that? T.S. Eliot was from St. Louis, for heaven's sake. And he had an English accent that was totally phony and everything. And everybody, and Sir T.S. Eliot, Thomas Stearns Eliot, and he was such a stuffed shirt. And Lewis really had nothing but disgust for him and thought he was bad because he was controlling literature, controlling poetry. One of the reasons he couldn't get the Daimier poem probably published in the 20s. And anyway, so he and his friends in 1926 decided to hatch up a plot to trick T.S. Eliot, who controlled the criteria. Their idea was that they were going to send, the idea came that broached us the idea of my literary dragonade. As dragons, they were going to attack Eliot. It would be a series of mock Eliotic poems to be sent to the Dial and the Criteria, see, that he controlled, until sooner or later one of these filthy editors falls into our trap. We both looked into T.S. Eliot's poems, which Benjamin had lent me, and York was pleased with the idea. He struck on a good opening line. My soul is a windowless facade. Remember, Eliot starts Prufrock with, let us go then, you and I, while the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized on a table. That's the great opening line of Prufrock. So he said, that's what we'll do. We'll use this opening line. My soul is a windowless facade. And then we hunted for a rhyme, and of course, Dissad, you know, the sadist, came up. Having the double merit of being irrelevant and offensive, both. So then we decided to bring Coghill in on the scheme as well. And so they hatched a scheme in which they really were going to try to trick him. And they went to dinner parties, and they just had more fun getting ready for this great attack on Eliot. And by the way, there's a little aside here for you for us as Americans. It's kind of cute because at one point they went to a dinner party where Gertrude Stein was present. And so he said, Coghill came to dinner and he told me of Gertrude Stein's gift of repartee. It was really like at a meeting in her honor the other night. Cecil rose to ask her what she meant by the same things being absolutely identical and absolutely different, a Gertrude Stein line. To which Stein, she's a dowdy American, replied, by the way, she's from San Francisco, California. Actually, originally, Gertrude Stein was from Oakland, California. I'm from Berkeley. She was from Oakland. And she's the one who made the famous line to her friend Alice P. Tokas in San Francisco, I went to Oakland, and there's no there there. The famous put down of Oakland came from Gertrude Stein. So anyway, so she said, he's a dowdy American, and she said, her line was that things are being absolutely identical and absolutely different. While you and the man next to you are absolutely identical by the way you both jump up to ask questions, but you're absolutely different in character. This nonsense was greeted with rounds of approving applause. I mean, he didn't like Gertrude Stein either. After coffee, we came here and joined with York and Hardy, and we read our Eliot poems and discussed plans of the campaign. Coghill thought that if we succeeded, it would always be open to Eliot to say that he had meant the poems seriously, that we had meant the poems seriously and after pretended they were parodies. His answer to this was to make them an acrostic. They were going to design a poem. They were going to try to get into Eliot's paper. And so it would be an acrostic. And the acrostic would be that if you went downward with the first line, the first word of every line, it would read this: sham poetry pays the world in its own coin, paper money. That would be the acrostic. And then came the brilliant idea that we should be a brother and a sister. Lewis was going to do this with his friend. Rollo and Bridget Considine. That was they were going to be. Bridget is the elder, and they were united by an affection so tender as to be almost incestuous. See, this is going to make them more interesting. Bridget will presently write a letter to Eliot, if we can get a foothold, telling him about her own and her brother's life. She's incredibly dowdy and about 35. See, they're creating these characters that are going to meet him at a party. And she's incredibly dowdy and about 35. We rolled in laughter as we pictured a tea party where the Considines meet Eliot. York would dress up for Bridget and perhaps bring a baby. We selected as our first shot the one poem by Rollo and Hardy's conversation poem and York's Sunday poem by Bridget. And they are to be sent from Vienna, where Hardy has a friend. We think Vienna will decrease suspicion and will also be a likely place for the Considines to live in. Well, I tell you, this is dressed. We went to university at 7:45, the Greats, for dinner. I sat next to Campbell, who is still a great admirer of T.S. Eliot, though he has transferred some of his admiration to Gertrude Stein. I asked him, and this is Lewis, I asked him if he'd heard of the Considines. See, he's trying to... A brother and sister, I believed, who lived in Vienna and who wrote remarkable stuff, but I doubted if any of it had appeared yet in England. He said he hadn't heard of it, but he was quite interested. Okay, I just thought I would read that. That was just show you. Now, nothing ever came of it. They never, ever pulled it off. So they never did do the scam of T.S. Eliot. But I read that because I brag about T.S. Eliot all the time, and I love him so much, but I have to tell you, Lewis later came to greatly appreciate T.S. Eliot. And especially because T.S. Eliot's great friend was Charles Williams. And Eliot wrote the introduction to All Hallows Eve, and Lewis adored Charles Williams. And so when he realized that Charles Williams had so much respect for T.S. Eliot, then he also began to respect Eliot. So that I did want to clear the air on that. But there's a humor in Lewis, and it's impish, and it runs through. You see it in the Chronicles of Narnia. We'll see that in a few weeks, but you see it all the way. Four, he keeps track of details, which is an essential mark of every good storyteller. Good storytellers keep track of details. In fact, he makes a little story of it. He says, details are so important. If you're telling a story to some children, in fact, children really need details. And you walk along, you said in the story, you walked along the street and you said, we walked along the street and we saw three hags sitting by the side of the road. I don't know. And now you're going to tell the story the next day. Now, remember when I told you how we walked along the street and we saw two hags sitting by the side of the road? Lewis said, every child will correct you. Because children love details. And the details are three hags. Don't forget, three, not two. And Lewis loves details. In The Magician's Nephew, he has, which is the second to the last of the novels he wrote, The Chronicles of Narnia, he tells about this witch who comes into England because they have a magic ring, and Polly and Diggory bring her into England by mistake, and when the police are chasing her, she grabs an English lamppost, and then they put the magic ring on, and they pull her back into Narnia. Where the ring takes him to. And then Aslan appears, and he's creating Narnia, and she throws the lampstand, that she yanked off a British lampstand, and she threw it at Aslan, hit him on the forehead. He reeled for a minute, but it didn't bother him that much. It fell to the ground, and Aslan's so powerful that when the lampstand fell to the ground, it grew. That's Magician's Nephew. But that's a detail. And every great story has details. Another detail is that when Aslan sends young Diggory and Polly up to get an apple so that he can plant a tree in Narnia that will protect Narnia for a long time against the Wicked Witch. And they bring the apple back. And he says, my mother is sick, because Lewis is always concentrating on that in his novels. His mother is sick. In Magician's Nephew, Diggory's mother is sick. And can I take an apple back for her? and will help her. And so Aslan gives her an apple to take back from this tree. And it does help his mother feel better after he gets back to England. And then he takes the apple and he plants it. And then it becomes a beautiful apple tree right there in his house. And it grows. And he said, it's a wonderful apple tree. And people had many, many apples off that tree. And it was so good. It didn't cure anybody of illnesses. But it was a wonderfully good tasting apple. And then one day a great storm came to England and knocked the tree down. And Diggory now had grown up. And he heard that the tree had been knocked down. And he felt so bad. So he sent carpenters back to cut the tree up and to make a wardrobe out of the tree. Does that ring a bell? Do you know who the old professor is in Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe? Diggory. That's why he said, that's why he's not so surprised when they went through that details. But if you're a lover of stories, and a lover of, especially stories of the marvelous, details make all the difference. That detail. What a gift. Lewis is a great master of detail. Five, he's a skillful creator of images and analogies. His analogies and images are absolutely marvelous. Let me just tell you one, is in the Mere Christianity, the book that's being given to you. In Mere Christianity, at the beginning of Mere Christianity, he says, I don't want to create a church. I don't want you to say you belong to my church now, but I like to think of this book as like a hallway, that you can walk in the hallway, but all the warm rooms where the fireplaces are off the hallway, and that's where you find warmth. And that's so in a way he creates this image that apologetics and theology that he's going to express in the broadcast talks are not creating a C.S. Lewis church. But he sees himself in his role as a hallway to get you into the hallway. But in the doors and all different kinds of rooms where there are different kinds of fireplaces, some better maybe than others for you. But that's where you get warm and that's where you get healed. And those are the churches. That's the way he creates that imagery, and that is the opening of Mere Christianity. In the book Miracles, he comes up with one of the most priceless sets of kind of fun imagery in his section on Christianity and religion. He has several great chapters here. The greatest chapter is the chapter on the grand miracle. I'll read parts of that to you next week. But he says this: men are reluctant to pass over from the notion of an abstract and negative deity to the living God. And I don't wonder, he said. An impersonal God, well and good. A subjective God of beauty, truth, and goodness inside our own heads, better still. A formless, by the way, does this sound like postmodernism? Wow. A formless life force surging through us with a vast power that we can tap, best of all. That's New Age. Wow. But he wrote this in 1946. Best of all. But God himself, alive, pulling at the other end of the cord, perhaps approaching at an infinite speed. The hunter, the king, the husband. Ah, that's quite a different matter. See the imagery? See what he's doing to you? You're no longer seeing it. You're hearing it and seeing it. Your own mind is creating the images now. There comes a moment. Now comes another one. There comes a moment when the children who've been playing burglars hush suddenly. Was that a real footstep in the hall? There comes a moment when people who've been dabbling in religion, man's search for God, suddenly draw back. Supposing we really found him, we never meant it to come to that. And he's like Chesterton. He's great for one-liners. Listen to this one-liner. Supposing we really found him, we never meant it to come to that. Worse still, supposing he found us. That's the way he ends the chapter on Christianity and religion. But with the imagery that is so alive and electric and totally catches you up. That's why I said it catches you off guard. That's Lewis with his imagery. Six. He's able to help us as readers to really know people, to meet people. You saw it with Aunt Lily. By the way, I left his father in shambles the other day because his father didn't come over to see this young boy, wounded in World War I in a hospital where he began to say, please, the long and the short of it is I'm lonely. Please come and see me. His mother's dead. His brother's off to war in Burma. And his dad is over in Ireland, and all he has to do is take a ferry across the English Channel, not the English Channel, but right from Ireland to Great Britain, and come and see his son in a hospital where he's there for 8 weeks. He doesn't do it. And that's why Lewis had a breach with his father. And that's why he moved in with Mrs. Moore and took care of Mrs. Moore and Maureen, and that part that his father didn't approve of, nor did his brother, and nor did a lot of his friends. His friends did not like Mrs. Moore. That's why Lewis had to have his inkling meetings at the pub and at his quarters in Oxford. He could not do it at his home. But then I want to read when his father, then they were reconciled. He and his father were reconciled. And there is just an absolutely moving scene here near the death of his father. He went to see his father, unlike his father not coming to see him. When his father was dying, he went over and saw him, and he was there 4 days before he died. And Lewis writes to his brother, who's away and can't be there. And here's what he writes about his father. That is really quite touching. I got to find my right page. By the way, a great deal of his jollities and wheezes, his father was always known for letting gas. They called him his wheezes. And he had a lot of flatulent problems. And so that's why the boys had a nickname for their father, OAB, Old Airbag, because that was one of his father's characteristics. By the way, fathers, your children know everything about you. And they'll make up things about you in terms of some of your weaknesses. So he says, by the way, a great deal of his jollities and wheezes remained to the end. One of the best things he ever said was the day before I left, 4 days before his death. As I came in, the day nurse said, I've just been telling Mr. Lewis that he's exactly like my father. And then Papa said, and how am I like your father, the nurse, while he's a pessimist? And Papa, after a pause, well, then I suppose he has several daughters. I tell you. As time goes on, now listen to Lewis describing his father. As time goes on, the thing that emerges is that whatever else he was a terrific personality. You remember, Johnson is dead. Let's go on to the next. There is none. No man can be said to put you in mind of Johnson. Remember the Boswell-Johnson papers? Nobody's quite like Johnson. How he filled a room. How hard it was to realize that physically he was not a big man. Our whole world is either direct or indirect testimony to the same effect. Take away from our conversation all that is imitation or parody, sincerest witness in the world, of his, and how little is left. The way we enjoyed going to Leeborough, that's their house in Belfast, and the way we hated it. The way we enjoyed hating it. As you say, one can't grasp that is over. And now you can do anything on earth you cared to do in his study at midday or on Sunday. And it's beastly. See, his father would not let them play on Sunday. But he said, now we can do anything we want. And he said, it's beastly. Isn't that what an interesting tribute, really, to his father. What a personality he had. He filled the room. And so Lewis, there was a reconciliation with his father at the end, and I'm grateful for that. Finally, Lewis dared to take on the two biggest themes in all of literature and philosophy. And his writings about these two great themes are both profound and totally helpful. One is the problem of evil. Lewis took on the problem of evil. He grappled with it. One of the first things he wrote after he became a Christian, even, of course, the Daimir poems were taking on the problem of evil, but from a pessimistic standpoint, strictly. So in a sense, he was just wallowing in evil with the Daimir poems, a little bit like Eliot with the Wasteland and also the Hollow Man, just sort of wallowing in it. But Lewis, after he became a Christian, one of his first books was The Problem of Pain. And I'll read from that next week. So that he wrote that in 1939, during the invasion of Poland. And when he saw what was happening as World War II was coming on the scene. And some of the other things he wrote where he grappled with the problem of evil, and he did it in the most powerful way. And also the possibility of good, especially ultimate good. It's victory over evil. It's victory over despair. And he grappled with that. These two grand themes. On the one hand, the facing up to crisis, facing up to tragedy, facing up to evil. What Tolkien calls catastrophe, facing up to catastrophe. And then I told you last week that Lewis became a Christian because Tolkien created an argument with him and said, you know, in every great story, there's a sense of catastrophe and eucatastrophe, good catastrophe. And then Tolkien said to him, Jesus Christ is the good catastrophe of all time. Only in our stories, it's in our imagination, but he is true. And Lewis, that brought everything together for Lewis. That's why his Daimyr poems don't make sense now. Because now he knows about catastrophe. The gospel of Christ enables us to see catastrophe and to see evil. And on the other hand, when you discover that Jesus Christ is able to heal and able to make you well, then you see eucatastrophe, the good catastrophe. And that evil is real, but good is greater. And Lewis even dared something else, which we'll look at when we look at the stories of the marvelous. He dared to do something even more than Tolkien did. Tolkien has good in The Lord of the Rings in a hidden fashion. Lewis decided to go all out and have good, ultimate good, totally knowable. Totally knowable and totally personal. In the great golden lion, Aslan, son of the emperor from beyond the sea. You get to know him. He knows you, you know him. And he goes that route and portrays that in the most marvelous way. And that's why his writing is so marvelous and so timeless. Because the great writers always do that. My hero, Dostoevsky, always does it in Crime and Punishment. You get the horror of the crime and then the hunt of Raskolnikov by Petrovich, the detective. He was kind of like a Columbo figure. Columbo was modeled after Petrovich, who's always said, oh, just one more question. Just one more little question. I love that in Columbo. That's right out of Crime and Punishment. And then Sonia, who's kind of a Christ figure. And there's this amazing recognition of evil. It's Sonia, the one who loves Raskolnikov, who says to Raskolnikov, you must go to the center of the city and kiss the earth, and you must say to the north, east, south, and west, I am a murderer. Wow. It's grace that has him do that. And then when he goes to Siberia, it's Sonia that follows him to Siberia. It's Sonia that gives him the New Testament to read about the raising of Lazarus. That's Crime and Punishment. In The Brothers Karamazov, Father Zosima, the great priest who has this marvelous gospel influence on Alyosha. And all the great novels always have to grapple. They have to grapple with the reality of evil and the possibility of hope, the possibility of redemption, the possibility of help. And Lewis does that. And that puts him, in my opinion, into the train of the great writers. And let me see. Do I have time to do a reading for you? I'm going to give you a gift tonight. I'm going to do a little reading for you. And I'm going to do it from The Magician's Nephew. Since I gave you a little bit of the plot from Magician's Nephew, I think I owe you a reading from The Magician's Nephew. This is just, settle back now. Lewis is so fun to listen to. I'm going to do a short reading from The Magician's Nephew. In The Magician's Nephew, we have met the witch. You know, she came into England and wreaked havoc and all. And then she even tried to stop Aslan when he was creating Narnia by throwing the lampstand at him, but it went to the ground and it grew too. And then Aslan creates this beautiful Narnia. He sings a song as Narnia is created. That's what Magician's Nephew is about. And then Aslan says to, when Diggory sees the power of Aslan, he says, wow, he knows that he's in Narnia. He doesn't, and he knows his mother is back in England sick. And he says to himself, maybe Aslan could help my mother. Wouldn't that be wonderful? And he's thinking, with all that power he just saw with the creation of Narnia, thinks that maybe Aslan will help him with his mother. And just about that point, this happens. Son of Adam, said Aslan, are you ready to undo the wrong you've done to my sweet country of Narnia on the very day of its birth when that wicked witch was brought in? Well, I don't see what I can do, said Diggory. You see, the queen ran away, and he's trying to explain how she got there. And then yes, said Diggory. And he had for a second some wild idea of saying, I'll try to help you if you promise to help my mother. But he realized in time that the lion was not at all the sort of person one could try to make bargains with. But when he said yes, he thought of his mother, and he thought of the great hopes he had, and how they were all dying away. And a lump came in his throat, and tears came in his eyes. And he blurted out, but please, please, won't you, can't you give me something that will cure mother? Up till then, he had been looking at the lion's great feet and the huge claws on them. And now in his despair, he looked up at its face. And what he saw surprised him as much as anything in his whole life. For the tawny face was bent down near his own. And wonder of wonders, great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, bright tears compared with Diggory's own, that for a moment he felt that as if the lion must really be sorrier about his mother than he was himself. My son, said Aslan, I know. Grief is great. Only you and I in this land know it yet. Let us be good to one another, but I have to think of hundreds of years in the life of Narnia. The witch whom you brought into this world will come back again to Narnia. We know that from Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe. We'll come back to Narnia, but it need not be yet. It's my wish to plant in Narnia a tree that she will not dare to approach, and that tree will protect Narnia for many, many years. So this land will have a long, bright morning before any clouds come over the sun. You must get me the seed from which that tree is to grow. So then Aslan sends this boy and his friend, Polly, on a journey. First he turns a horse, an ordinary horse, into a great flying horse named Fledge. And so Fledge is going to be this flying horse that will fly this boy, Diggory, and Polly way up to a garden. It's to be way in the northern part. It takes 2 days to get there. And they fly up there to this place where they're to come to a garden. And Aslan tells them, in a garden there will be a tree. And he's to get one apple from the tree. He's not to eat it, but he's to get that apple and bring it back so it can be planted. And so when he comes to that garden, he finds the garden. He sees a poem, the garden. The garden says, come in by golden gate, or not at all. Take of my fruit for others, or forbear. For those who steal, or those who climb thy wall, shall find their heart's desire and find despair. That's a poem he sees. So he remembers what Aslan said, and so he gets the apple, and he's back, walking back from the garden to get on Fledge with Polly, and they're going to fly back to Aslan with the apple. He was turning back to the gates when he stopped to have one last look. He got a terrible shock. He was not alone. There, only a few yards away from him, stood the witch. She was just throwing away the core of an apple that she had just eaten. The juice was darker than you would expect, and it made a horrid stain around her mouth. Diggory guessed at once that she must have climbed over the wall, and he began to see that there might be some sense in that last line about getting your heart's desire and getting despair along with it. For the witch looked stronger and prouder than ever, and even in a way triumphant, but her face was deadly white, white as salt. All this flashed through Diggory's mind in a second. Then he took to his heels and ran for the gates as hard as he could pelt. The witch was after him. As soon as he was out, the gates closed behind him of their own accord. That gave him the lead, but not for long. By the time he had reached the others, he was shouting, quick, get up, Polly, get up, Fledge. The witch had climbed the wall, was vaulting over it, was close behind them. Stay where you are, cried Diggory, turning round to face her, or we'll all vanish. Remember, they have the magic ring. They can vanish with that ring. Don't come an inch nearer. Foolish boy, said the witch, why do you run from me? I mean you no harm. If you do not stop and listen to me now, you will miss some knowledge that you would have made you happy all your life. I don't want to hear it, thanks, said Diggory, but he did. I know what errand you've come on, continued the witch, for it was I who was close beside you in the woods last night, and I heard all your counsel. You have plucked fruit in the garden, and you have it in your pocket now, and you're going to carry it back untasted to the lion for him to eat, for him to use. You simpleton, do you not know what that fruit is? I will tell you. It is the apple of youth, the apple of life. I know, for I taste it. I already feel such changes in myself. I know I shall never grow old or die. Eat it, boy, eat it. And you and I will both live forever and be king and queen of this whole world. Or your world, too, if you decide to go back. No thanks, said Diggory. I don't know that I care much about living on and on after everybody else is dead. I'd rather live an ordinary time and then die and go to heaven. But what about this mother of yours, whom you pretend to love so? What's she got to do with it, said Diggory. Don't you see, fool, that one bite of that apple would heal her? You have in your pocket that apple. We are here by ourselves, the lions far away. Use your magic and go back to your own world. A minute later, you'll be at your mother's bedside, giving her the fruit. 5 minutes later, you will see color coming back into her face. She will tell you the pain's gone. Soon she will tell you she feels stronger, and then she'll fall asleep. Think of that, hours of sweet, natural sleep, without pain, without drugs. Next day, everyone will be saying how wonderfully she's recovered. Soon you'll be quite well again. All will be well. Your home will be happy again, and you will be like other boys. Can you see Lewis working feelings of his through his life? Oh, gasped Diggory, as if he'd been hurt. He put his hand to his head, for he knew now a terrible choice lay before him. What has this lion ever done for you that you should be a slave, said the witch? What can he do to you once you're back in your own world? And what would your mother think if she knew, that you could have taken her pain away and given her life back to her and saved your father's heart from being broken, but you wouldn't? That you'd rather run messages for a wild animal in a strange world that's no business of yours. I don't think he's a wild animal, said Diggory in a dried up sort of voice. He is, I don't know. And then he's something worse, said the witch. Look what he's done to you already. Look how heartless he's made you. That's what he does to everyone who listens to him, cruel, pitiless boy. You could let your mother die rather than... Oh, shut up, said the miserable Diggory, still in the same voice. Do you think I don't see? But I promised. Ah, but you didn't know what you were promising. There's no one here that can prevent you. Mother herself, said Diggory, getting the words out with difficulty. She wouldn't like it. Awfully strict about keeping promises and not stealing and all that sort of thing. She'd tell me not to do it, quick as anything, if she were here. But she need never know, said the witch, speaking more sweetly than you would have ever thought someone with such a fierce face could speak. You wouldn't tell her how you got the apple. Your father need never know. No one in your world need know anything about the whole story. You needn't take this little girl back with you, you know. That's where the witch made her fatal mistake. Of course, Diggory knew that Polly could get away with her own ring as easily as he could. But apparently the witch didn't know. You know, evil never knows as much as it says. And the meanness of the suggestion that he would leave Polly behind suddenly made all the other things the witch had been saying to him sound false and hollow. And even in the midst of all his misery, his head suddenly cleared. And he said in a different and much louder voice, "Look here, where do you come into all of this? Why are you so precious fond of my mother and all of a sudden? And what's it got to do with you? What's your game?" "Good for you, Diggs," whispered Polly in his ear. "Quick, get away now." She hadn't dared to say anything all through the argument because, you see, it wasn't her mother who was dying. "Up then," said Diggory, heaving her to the fledge's back. And scrambling up, he quickly as he could, and the horse spread its wings. "Go then, fools," cried the witch. "Think of me, boy, when you're old and weak and dying. Remember how you threw away your chance at endless youth. It won't be offered to you again." They were already so high they could only just hear her. Nor did the witch waste any time gazing up at them. They saw her set off northward down the slope of the hill. They had started early in the morning, and so that Fledge and Polly both said they would be easily get back to Narnia before nightfall. Diggory never spoke on the way back, and the others were shy of speaking to him. He was very sad, and he wasn't even sure all the time that he had done the right thing. But whenever he remembered the shining tears in Aslan's eye, he became sure. Magician's nephew.